And so, first of all, everything in this talk will be conventional. I think when I was preparing it, I concluded that meant I was crazy. The basic point of the talk is going to be that as we try to do large-scale structure observations to higher and higher degrees of precision, we go to larger scales and get more modes in the almost linear regime, there are new types of weird things that will go on in these surveys that we need to be thinking about, and we need to be thinking about what to do with them. And one of those is the effect of intrinsic galaxy alignments combined with anisotropic selection effects on large-scale structure. And the two papers this is based on are my paper last year on redshift space distortions. We now have a new paper with Elizabeth Krause on the effect on the galaxy bispectrum. So where I'm going to go, I will briefly motivate the use of large-scale structure to measure the growth of structure. Then I'll quickly go through what tidal alignments of galaxies can do to this. And I'll show you the cartoon version. Then I'll actually walk through some of the formalism and some of the try to do a couple of models. And see how large this effect, these effects might be, in particular on the redshift space distortions, and I'll just spend the last couple of minutes on the bispectrum. I think the redshift space distortions are my bigger point today. As we've heard the past couple of days, now that we know the universe is accelerating and so on, and we talk about is it dark energy or modified gravity, clearly, one of the things we want to do is measure W as a function of Z and, you know, measure the distance ladder and so on. But we also want to measure the growth of structure because this, you know, this is, provides a test of whether the standard linear perturbation theory with smoothly distributed dark energy accurately describes how structure grows in the universe. And in particular, we go after our friends, the growth function and the rate of growth of structure with parameterized by this dimensionless number f that's 1 in the high redshift matter-dominated universe. And we have a variety of ways of doing this. This is not even complete. I spent most of my time in my thesis in the first few years after, doing weak gravitational lensing, where you're measuring shears, which are, of course, the integral of the second derivative of the potential. That's how I got interested in, you know, how galaxies are all lined up. Are they going to mess up weak lensing? That's an interesting subject, but it's a different talk. I won't say much today about ISW or clusters, except that they're important and they've been covered by some of the other talks. What I mostly want to focus on were the large-scale structure observables, the redshift space distortions, which use the compression of galaxies in redshift space along the line of sight due to velocity gradients, and the galaxy bispectrum, which tries to use the weakly nonlinear evolution. You may be wondering at this point what lining up all the galaxies has to do with large-scale structure, right? In large-scale structure survey, I'm not measuring the shapes of galaxies. I'm just counting them, and I'm getting RA, deck, and redshift. The trick is that there are two reasons which, when combined, mean that we need to think about this. One is that there are galaxy orientations, those are presumably determined by such things as the triaxiality of the host halo in the case of elliptical galaxies, or the angular momentum of whichever baryons end up in the disk in the case of spirals. And both of these are somehow affected by large-scale tidal fields. And there's a long history of literature going back to this that you can find referenced in the paper, but it goes back many decades. Clearly, a tidal field affects the way in which a halo is going to collapse, and which dimensions collapse first, and which axis mergers are most likely to occur on. And those same tidal fields, if you're looking at disk galaxies, will torque the baryons and somehow affect their orientation. So that's an issue for weak lensing, but when I combine it with orientation-dependent selection effects, if seeing a galaxy depends on whether it's, in the case of a disk, for example, its angular momentum is pointed at me or 90 degrees away, then I've now got a selection bias that enters into large-scale structure, right? My galaxy density is not just modulated by the local matter over density, which we normally think of as true on large scales, but also by the local tidal field and whether it points along the line of sight or not. So at cartoon level, here's what's going on. This is my cartoon picture of redshift space distortions. So in all of these plots, I put the observer's down here at the bottom. He's looking up, and he's looking at some Fourier mode in the galaxy field. In the left panel, that Fourier mode is perpendicular to the line of sight. Here, it's parallel. And I've supposed that I'm looking, for example, at elliptical galaxies. They tend to be aligned with the tidal field. The effect is shown in the figure is, of course, an exaggeration. I've also assumed that you use, for example, aperture or isophotal magnitudes to select these guys, because every survey in one or another way has some magnitude cut. And in doing so, I select against galaxies that are pointed perpendicular to me instead of parallel. And as you can see, in this particular case, in the left panel, that effect has amplified the pre-existing Fourier mode. And in the right-hand panel, it has de-amplified it, because the galaxies I'm missing here lived in under-dense regions, and here they lived in over-dense regions. So I've produced this spurious effect that looks in some ways like a redshift space distortion. As I'll show you later, the functional dependence is actually the same as well. And then at the very end, I'll tell you some ideas for how you might get rid of something like that.
Is it stronger in the overdense as compared to the underdense regions?
That's true, but I'm not using that. Rather, I'm just using the fact that in the overdense regions, the tidal field is stretching. Stretching towards other over densities and away from the under densities, right? And you know, here the same thing is true, but the tidal field reverses sign if I move through half a cycle.
So we have just one mode, which is at the same time density mode, but also it gives you the tidal field.
Yes, and of course because they're both sourced by the density field, those are the density field, the tidal field are exactly the same Fourier modes.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll briefly go over how one might calculate something like this. More details can be found in appendices A through D. If you want to develop a theory of galaxy orientations and what they do for large scale structure. The orientation of any object is described by three Euler angles, or equivalently with the rotation matrix. It's an SO3. And the observer is looking in some direction towards that galaxy, and that direction is a unit vector. It lives in S2. So the probability that you're actually going to see that galaxy must depend on your line of sight observing direction rotated into the frame of the galaxy. That probability has some modulation factor, which I call epsilon, and PowerPoint displays that as a y. There's some observing direction rotated into the galaxy's frame, since I want this to just be the anisotropic part, I'll make that integrate to zero and absorb the mean proportionality, which is not my concern today. There's the picture. I've got a galaxy. I've got an observing direction. I've got some Euler angles. And this probability that I end up selecting the galaxy, you know, depends in some way on taking this and back rotating it through those three angles. That's for a general galaxy. If the galaxy is axisymmetric, which you might take as a first approximation to a disk galaxy, this third Euler angle doesn't matter. The rest of the formalism goes through the same way. What it's going to do to the observed density of galaxies is that the number density of galaxies I observe somewhere, I integrate over all possible orientations of the probability of being in that orientation at that position, of a galaxy being in that orientation, modulated by this selection probability that depends on orientation. Probabilities integrate to one, so I can pick out the first piece. This orientation dependent selection effect combined with tidal alignments and so on is captured in this integral. The first piece of this integral, the probability distribution of the orientation, is a statement about tidal alignments, or the probability that a galaxy is oriented this way or that way. The second piece is a statement about my selection effects. In order to get this combination of things, which I'll call epsilon, to be non-zero, in order to have an effect on large-scale structure observables, I need to have both an intrinsic alignment effect, and I need to have an anisotropic selection effect. So any type of galaxy survey where you've got both ingredients, you need to worry about what's going to happen. The good news is because, you know, I've got two not enormously large things when I start multiplying them, this is small enough that I can tell you the first bottom line, which is that those large-scale structure papers after the past few years, you should still believe. Unless Jeff Newman tells you not to, but
I'll believe you on this.
Okay. we're not there yet. But onto models for this effect. The first model that I'll consider here is the model I mentioned for the elliptical galaxies. This is one that was of particular concern to me. Because large-scale alignment of LRGs is not just a theory; it's a reality. I think we understand, at least phenomenologically, what this looks like. The detections of luminous red galaxies being aligned with, in the case of BCGs, with the host cluster. And more generally with large-scale structure, is a 30-year-old subject, and the effect has gotten stronger ever since then, right? If you go from one survey to the next with more galaxies, the number of sigmas of detection goes up, which is a sign that it's real. Depending on how you work with these things, can have orientation-dependent selection effects. Because if I start doing, for example, aperture magnitudes, which are a reasonable choice if you want to maximize signal to noise when you put a fiber on something, this is not how the Sloan LRG survey was done, but it's just as a warning, it's something that you could do, and you need to think about the consequences. This is a theorist's LRG. If I look down this direction versus this direction, I just see a different flux. I should say that because LRGs are optically thin in most cases, If you actually fit a model and used a model that base magnitude for your cuts, you should in principle be able to get rid of this effect, at least to the extent that your model fits. So what functional form is this going to take? Well, you expect that these things will be aligned by the tidal field. So the first thing you write down is something that's linear in the tidal field. So the tidal field is this object here. I take the matter density, I convert it to a potential, I take two derivatives, and I subtract off, that should be 1/3 delta ij, you subtract off the isotropic piece. And then that's a tidal field, has two indices. And so I need to multiply by the line of sight twice to get rid of the indices. So that I have a scalar observable quantity. And there's some normalization coefficient. And that's just the only thing I can write down. And that's a key point. Whether you believe that the alignment of luminous red galaxies is some phenomenon associated with the shape of the host halo, or it has to do with mergers, or it has to do with anisotropic collapse, or whatever, it depends on the tidal field, and you'll get the same functional form. So that's both good in terms of being able to predict things, and bad in terms of you measure this, it doesn't really tell you where it came from. So one can go through the process of trying to estimate what A1 is. In order to do that, of course, you need an idea of what the intrinsic alignment amplitude for luminous red galaxies is. So I went back to my measurements from Sloan. This is work I did with Rachel Mandelbaum and Mustafa Ishak. This was not at all the first detection of this, but I think it was the highest signal to noise, at least at the time. You have a bunch of luminous red galaxy samples, and this is a projected correlation function of the ellipticities of those galaxies with the positions of other nearby galaxies. And it has this actually the same slope as the galaxy-galaxy correlation function for the same reason. It's the same number of tidal fields, densities are the same number of derivatives of potential. So you expect that, and so it's good that that works. So these are Sloan luminous red galaxy samples. These were split by whether it's the brightest galaxy in the halo, as determined by some finder. These are all density shaped correlation functions. The galaxy correlation function, it's not quite R to the minus 0.7, but it's pretty close. Compared to the size of error bars you see here, I think they would be consistently the same. One can go through that exercise with the luminous red galaxies. Yeah.
Can you explain this a bit better? What is the reason that if galaxy is pointing towards me, I see it more often or less often?
You're doing a spectroscopic survey, right? You put a fiber on a galaxy for some reason, and you go through the list of cuts you make. And you ask, is there a preference for one orientation over the other? And for most ways of writing down those cuts, the answer is yes, there is.
Yeah, but I mean, as you said, they are optically thin, so they have the same luminosity as I see them.
Well, but the peak flux is different. So if you don't fit the full model, if you're just going to cut, say, on the brightest part of the galaxy, which you usually do, if you have fiber
Is that how it's done? Do you just fit the brightest?
Well, they're trying to fit the model, but usually, I mean, very often they just take some sort of integrated flux inside some small circle. So the more perpendicular it is, the more flux is going to lose.
This is more of an issue in doing a spectroscopic survey than a properly executed photometric survey. The aperture magnitudes properly executed are not going to be significantly affected by this, but the Sloan spectra, for example, because the fibers are quite small on the sky relative to the full extent of the galaxies, is significantly affected.
Since we're going to be talking about redshift, the redshift basis storage is part of this. You would ask them to spectroscopic survey.
So the point is that you it's not that you lose the other ones, you just don't get spectra for them.
Yeah, you put fiber on it.
A combination of whether you decide to put fiber on it and at the single noise limit of the survey where always many of your objects live, you know, you'll be successful with your redshift.
Thank you.
So you would think, as a very naive theorist, that people would select the galaxies in a different way.
Well,
they took the spectrum. You'd select it in a way which was not sensitive to this.
Well, sometimes that's possible, and sometimes it's not. And
the limitations of the spectroscopy itself still dominate.
Yeah, well, it's slow and they don't. But if you start talking about these future surveys where people are spending enormous amounts of money, then you know every left hook has a spike down. Any more questions on this one? Okay. So on to the
slightly more speculative part, which is disk galaxies. Yes.
Model predictions for this, and this is just observation, but is there any model that?
This model predicts a shape for the correlation.
Yeah, but at A1, like, do simulations tell you what A1 should be, or?
I don't know. For theory, what A1 should be. I tried writing down a couple of toy theories for A1, and they gave me the wrong answer, and the wrong luminosity dependence, and the wrong redshift dependence, so I never published them.
That's probably right choice. But I guess it makes sense because I guess it may depend on the fibers, and I mean, okay, so that's kind of, that's not the theory part, it's just the observational part.
You completely get rid of this phenomenon. You could take a redshift survey from several hundred megaparsecs away and get all angles on the galaxy, but you can't do that.
So if you are able to put the fiber directly at the center, if you have this selection effect, but in your observation there are seams, so you may not really focus at the center. Given this, would the probability observe the galaxy along the line side still higher? So if it is elongated along the line side, so it will become smaller, right? So, and due to the same problem, so you may have a smaller chance to focus to the center. So this effect would kind of offset the other effect.
If the seeing is sufficiently bad, or your fiber is sufficiently large that all of these things are essentially point objects, then you'll be in this regime. You know, point object, there's just a flux. But LRGs are never point objects, like they have this extended tail as you go out of the profile. And the De Vogt-Lorentz profile converges very, very slowly.
So I'll talk about the disk galaxies next. The theory that we learned in school for disk galaxy tidal alignments, and I'm still not entirely sure how valid this is, but it's worth thinking about the consequences. Is that they get spun up by tidal torques from large scale structure. You can calculate the torque on something with an anisotropic moment of inertia tensor sitting in some tidal field. And then what ends up happening is that you end up with some distribution of angular momenta that's not isotropic, and that would be second order. Quadratic order in the tidal field, because you need one tidal field to produce the anisotropic moment of inertia tensor of your collapsing galaxy, and another tidal field to torque it. So you need two powers of the tidal field. If you write down things that have two powers of the tidal field, So you go to this, so the previous slide, I had a tidal tensor, and I said my selection probability is proportional to the tidal tensor projected onto the line of sight. I can also write down a term that's quadratic in the tidal tensor. And if you have a bunch of disk galaxies and there's a selection in favor of things that aren't Bessonian, because there's less extinction as the radiation tries to get out of them, then something like this is what you would expect. And I could also have written down terms, this is a sort of L equals 2 type term. I could also have written down L equals 4 type terms and so on, but I'm not going to concern myself with those at the moment. So you end up with this other type of intrinsic alignment that's described by this A2 parameter. If you just write down this argument, you would think that for disk galaxies, that is the dominant effect. I should note that Hui and Zheng had this very nice paper where they show that if you take account of nonlinear evolution in the density field, that this mechanism also predicts you would get something like a linear term as well, which may dominate on large scales. So I'll talk about upper limits to that, but I don't think anyone has ever observed something that's this fact. Since I'm short on time, I'll skip the detailed models, except to say that we have an upper limit on A1, which you can do by the argument I had with the Sloan galaxies. If you look at blue galaxies in Sloan, you don't see this density ellipticity correlation, so I can just set an upper limit. I don't have a measurement of the A2 term, the second term. And I should mention someone should go ahead and measure that. There have been a number of papers, including some by people in this room, on disk galaxy alignments, but nobody's ever measured A2. So I would be interested in seeing that. In the meantime, we just took a guess from the simplest versions of tidal torque theory, and you get something of order unity, and maybe that's too large. What is this going to do to redshift space distortions? I've given you all of the theory, so I could just go ahead and write down what happens to the observed galaxy density fluctuation if I have this alignment effect. And the answer is that it contains a standard biasing term, right? There are more galaxies in overdense regions. There is a velocity gradient term, which is the standard linear redshift space compression of objects in redshift space due to the velocity gradient along the line of sight. That's the effect that in redshift space distortion cosmology we're trying to measure. And now there's this new effect. And when I stack them all together, those are the three terms, I've got this new thing going on here. If I Fourier transform and convert my grads into k's, then I get something like this. And what you should notice is that two things have happened. One is that there's a change in the galaxy bias, which is pretty small. And since normally we throw out the galaxy bias anyway, if we're trying to do cosmology, the fact there's a slight change in the galaxy bias, okay, doesn't really matter. But the redshift space distortion piece picks up this additional term that has the same functional form as standard redshift space distortions. And the origin of both of these is that the linear tidal field is actually producing both the redshift space distortion, because it's the source of velocity gradients, and it's producing this tidal alignment effect. So there's a reason why they look the same. It is a function of the galaxy type. It is a function of luminosity. It's greater for brighter LRGs. It could be a function of redshift. It can have all the same dependencies that the bias can have.
Shouldn't the effect of the alignment be the dependent on the tidal tensor smooth on a, like the small scale tidal tensor, right? It's not the large scale tidal
field. It sees the superposition of all tidal fields on scales larger than the size of the galaxy.
But then I suppose, since it's linear, when you average a lot of galaxies, then you just get the largest scale tidal field.
If you look at a Fourier mode with a wavelength of 100 megaparsecs, and you count galaxies, take that Fourier mode of the galaxy distribution, right, you are actually averaging out all the smaller scale tidal fields. You know, maybe there's some nonlinear interaction going on, but at large scales, you know, it's a mapping from the tidal field associated with that mode to the same Fourier mode.
So I have actually a question. So do you think the second order terms are small compared to the first order terms? In the expansion, the A2 terms, basically.
For the case of that's a good question. For the case of the disk galaxies, maybe not. Mm-hmm. If there's a reason why you'd expect the largest piece to be quadratic, then maybe that dominates. Then I'll get to that at the end. How long do I have?
We started at least 10 minutes.
Okay, that should be fine.
To give you some the numbers that come out of the arguments I gave you earlier, so these are just examples. But if you take some fairly bright, LRGs, we're talking about effects that are maybe around the few percent level. So I think all of the current measurements of redshift space distortions are okay, but next few generations of surveys, you start going to larger scales, things get more linear, you start to worry about things like this. The disk galaxies, this is an upper limit, at least at low redshift. I say at least at low redshift when people start talking about high redshift surveys. You know, we had this issue in weak lensing. You know, you start looking at redshift 1 galaxies, are the intrinsic alignments going to be much stronger than they are today? Maybe, you know, in the past, you know, few billion years, the galaxies have all precessed their halos and randomized their orientations, but they were initially strong. But as we start talking about the high redshift surveys, you know, the caveat is that, you know, these things could in principle get worse. Although Rachel Mantelbaum and company have been looking at this, no one has anything at redshift greater than 1 yet. As we talk about really high redshift things, I should mention this effect because it's kind of interesting. Zheng Zheng and company had a paper where they looked at the redshift space clustering of Lyman alpha emitters at high redshift. And they actually see a very similar effect to what I was showing you, and they see it for what are in some ways the same reasons. They see a huge effect with a similar functional form, but opposite sign to the linear redshift space distortions. The macrophysical reason is the same. The Lyman alpha emitters, at least in their simulations, have an anisotropic selection effect that's determined by the tidal field, and consequently has the same scale and angular dependence as the redshift space distortion. But the microphysical reason why they see that is very different. It has to do with Lyman alpha photons trying to get out of high redshift galaxies. And in a region with high along a line of sight with high velocity gradient, you're more able to escape. You get yourself out of the resonance line faster. So Zheng Zheng et al. are aligning the IGM, the infalling gas, into the galaxy, whereas the effect that I've been talking about is actually aligning the galaxy itself. Nevertheless, in some sense, they're two sides of the same coin. But this effect, at least at high redshift, is much stronger. And, you know, if you're doing redshift space distortions with light and alpha emitters, you probably do want to be concerned about that. Okay, so in my last few minutes, I'll briefly talk about the galaxy bispectrum. So this is another way that people like to talk about breaking the degeneracy between galaxy bias and sigma 8. It's somewhat less popular than the redshift space distortion because it has to work in the nonlinear regime. It's a leading order nonlinear effect. And so if you're going to do this, you have to be careful to use scales that are nonlinear but not so nonlinear that you can't do anything with them, and it all depends on dot catalogs and so on. Nevertheless, the data to do this exists. It's been done by Licia Verde and company in 2DF, and more such data will exist in the future. And just to remind you of how this works, the idea is that if I expand the galaxy over density and powers of the matter density, so I get a second-order biasing coefficient. Then when I compute the bispectrum of galaxies, I can write in terms of the matter power spectrum and the nonlinear coupling coefficients, and then I have to sum over all permutations that contribute to this. And there's a piece that comes from the nonlinear evolution of the matter field, and there's some kernel, which I won't write down yet, that describes that. And there's a piece associated with this second-order bias, and they have different configuration dependencies. So you can go ahead and isolate this term, and because it depends on sigma 8 and bias in a way that's different from sigma 8b, which determines the amplitude of the galaxy correlation function, one can separately solve for these guys. So what do intrinsic alignments have to do with this? Well, if I take my previous intrinsic alignments model and put it in here, or more precisely, if I ask Elizabeth Krause to do it, she returns to me this formula for the correction to the galaxy bispectrum. So this is the piece from the linear intrinsic alignment term. And all that did was change the galaxy biasing parameters again, at least if you're looking at, this is the transverse bispectrum, the bispectrum that you would measure either in a photometric survey or from the perpendicular to line of sight nodes in a spectroscopic survey. Because that's simply rescaling the bias parameters, it's not changing sigma 8. But the quadratic alignment term, as you might guess, because it produces a correction to the galaxy density that's second order in the tidal field and hits the matter density field, gives you something like this. So you can see here there's this new non-trivial fact that there's this new coupling here that involves K1 dot K2 squared that shows up in the bispectrum. And if you compare to the nonlinear evolution kernel that governs the matter evolution, you'll see that these things are different because this one has this dipole term in it that's associated with galaxies being, one Fourier mode being moved around by the velocity field of the other Fourier mode. That doesn't happen here. The bottom line is that these two, this intrinsic alignments term in the case of the bispectrum actually has a different functional form than the signal you're looking for. And that's a good thing. In pictures, here's what it looks like. This is a reduced galaxy bispectrum as a function of the angle of the triangle. So this is from Elizabeth Krause's paper, and she's taken triangles and looked at the reduced bispectrum as a function of this angle. And when you turn on this quadratic alignment term, you get a different shape. It's kind of cool. Here's what that does to the parameters. So if you simply ignore the fact that you've got this additional effect going on, and you assign A2, the quadratic alignment amplitude, to have a value of unity, which may be the right order of magnitude, although maybe not, could be less than that. So this one here, I guess we should look at, you should look at this plot first, for example. The vertical axis here is sigma 8. And if you ignore that new effect when you're doing your data analysis, you get a bias that takes you from this correct fiducial model up to here. If you simultaneously try to fit out this additional configuration dependence, it debiases you, it pulls you back here, but of course the error bar grows. The usual thing that happens when you project out new effects. In principle, this is something that can be fixed, but probably we want to do a lot more work on that. All right, I'll wrap up now. The main things you want to take away are that the tidal alignments of galaxies, if I combine them with anisotropic selection effects, affect large-scale structure observables. In particular, both the redshift space distortions and the bispectrum, which we use as measures of the growth function, are affected in somewhat different ways. The redshift space distortions are exactly degenerate in the linear regime with the new tidal alignment effect. So if you try to do redshift space distortions at a level where this is significant, you're either going to have to try to knock down the effect or model it somehow. In the case of the bispectrum, there are so many additional types of triangles going around that pretty much any two effects look different. The same is true here. But there is an increase in the error bars when you try to do that. As I said, the cures, particularly the redshift space distortion effects case, are that you would either try to reduce selection effects or model them, or some combination thereof.
So, could you go back to the slide where you show this new effect of bispectral kernel from the quadratic? Yeah. So, F2, for example, as you know, vanishes when you take K1 equals minus K2 to the squeeze limit, because gravity can't couple zero mode to the small. But this new term seems to be able to do that, right? When K1 equals minus K2.
This one, right?
Yeah.
This is not.
So when K1 dot K2 is 1, you still get non-zero distribution. But why is that? Is there any intuition there? What's coupling one way around function?
I haven't thought about that. Let's see. So one thing is this is just the transverse methods. I would guess that if you did a truly isotropic average over all orientations of the triangle, not restricting it to be in plane, that you would get zero.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Is it transverse?
No, this is where the K1, K2, K3 are at the plane of the sky. The paper contains the formula where it's not at the plane of the sky, and then you get all kinds of additional terms. I just built the whole slide.
I see. Okay.
Jeff?
Okay. So if you measure the bispectrum and the redshift space distortions with the same survey, does the bispectrum give you enough information to eliminate the A1, A2 effects for the redshift space distortions?
So,
make them negligible, make the uncertainty negligible from that?
For the transverse bispectrum piece, I think the answer is no, because the if that were the only piece you had, because you're rescaling the bias parameters. This is the same rescaling as you had in the previous case, so you can't measure A1 from it. And B2, I don't know what it was to start with. If you ask if I had the full redshift space by spectrum, is there a way I could do that? That I don't know the answer to. That's a good idea.
Wiley?
Also, only for these things to matter, you will have enough signal noise in those surveys to measure your A1s and A2s and all these parameters. In which case, isn't it just a matter of correcting the selection function for the known effect when it's there and you're done?
Knowing A1 is not trivial, because I need to know, for example, in the case of an LRG, it probably is. But in the case of something like this galaxy, you know, if I think about, you know, an oxygen 2 line, for example, trying to escape from a galactic disk, and, you know, it's I think of this as, I look at a disk sketch, there's more extinction, right? But that line can also rescatter in the galaxy. It's a nasty radiative transfer problem, and, you know, if you're thinking maybe at the factor of 2 level...
You can measure it, you don't have to know it. You can measure it, and then you measure it, you do the first analysis, then you know what your shear field even was, and you can go back, knowing the shear field, and correct the selection function.
Yeah, there's a long history of people trying to measure the dimming of galaxies as a function of inclination angle, and there are a number of ways to do it, but I think they require external data. You might try something like take your V over A ratio in the case of nearby galactic disks, and you could play games like I have an optical luminosity function as a function of inclination angle, and I try to match that something in K-band and argue that K-band is much less affected by extinction. So there are ways to do it, but I think just from the redshift survey data itself, you might have a hard time.
So, has there been any test of this tidal curve theory in simulation flight?
In simulations, yes. But if you then asked, you could play the game. Suppose someone came into this room and told you that tidal torque theory does not apply to the real universe. What would you say? And there are a large number of studies of correlations of, you know, orientations of nearby disk galaxies. The problem is they tend to be low significance. And I worry a little bit about that. You know, this is a subject with a lot of history. Why are we still getting, you know, 2 and 3 sigma detections in SLEDM? That to me is deeply worrying. And the other thing is, generally, the number of things like, you know, bispectrum configuration dependences and all of that, the amount of information that you have to actually identify whether you're seeing a quadratic term. I don't think anyone's identified their measurement with that effect.
Okay, let's thank Chris again.
Next speaker is Boo.